water quality enforcement policy from Chris Kerrigan and Yvonne West.
Just very briefly, I wanted to thank Chris Kerrigan and Yvonne West for coming. Shinrei Lee, our assistant executive officer, serves as our enforcement officer for the North Coast region, and Shinrei worked with Chris and Yvonne in the concept for what we were hoping for this item, and Chris has put together a great presentation. It's to focus on the recent revisions to the enforcement policy, and thank you both very much for being here.
My pleasure, Matt. Good morning, board members, executive staff. My name is Chris Kerrigan. I'm the chief of the Office of Enforcement at the State Water Resources Control Board, but I really had to go by Chris. This is one of my senior prosecutors, Yvonne West, and she is the lead liaison for the Region 1 enforcement team. So at Office of Enforcement, we have three attorneys available on call to work with your enforcement staff, whether it be in the field, like, hey, I want to go on this property, do I need a warrant, or is this an NOV? Those kinds of questions, and what are the legal words and terminology that we should use. Yvonne's the senior attorney who's worked here, and she's also the lead on our cannabis enforcement team, so it's a good marriage of functions for Yvonne. So I'm going to briefly go over four things today, and I'm hoping that, so which one goes forward? Sorry, I'm...
A little button to the right.
Okay. So today, I'm going to kind of talk about four things, and I'd love to take questions on each of the topics as we go and engage with the board members. I'm more of an iterative kind of person. I'm going to talk really briefly about the Office of Enforcement and our structure and services. I think that should go quickly. I'm going to then talk about the amendments to the water quality enforcement policy. We'll go through some of the mechanics of that, some of the concepts there. And I'll ask for questions when we get through that component of it. And there's three main parts to the water quality enforcement amendments. And then we'll talk about settlement considerations for penalty cases and how the staff goes through settlement dialogue and how the board has opportunity to weigh in on and or participate in a settlement process or negotiation. Not necessarily negotiation, but the settlement orders. And then I'll talk a little bit about SEPs, and I think based on our earlier dialogue, I'm going to kind of give a broad overview and talk a little bit about possibilities, and then maybe ask Matt if I can come back and get into more detail with the SEP approach with the board members, if you're inclined to want to do that. So there's my org chart. That's sufficiently confusing, but I like to have some exhibits that are non-text.
Whatever you want.
But just to tell you what's going on here is I have a legal unit with 15 attorneys in it. The legal unit provides support for all of our clients. I also have a UST unit that does underground storage tank compliance and leak prevention enforcement. So that's a technical unit of mainly environmental scientists and geologists, and they're just focused on that one topic because the regional boards do a lot of regulatory work with USTs, but we do the health and safety code leak prevention enforcement in our shop. We also have a fraud, waste, and abuse prevention unit that goes out to make sure that persons and consultants are not bilking the cleanup fund by submitting false or misleading requests for reimbursement. Our fraud, waste, and abuse prevention unit now is branching out to look at grants and other funding mechanisms at the state board since we're finding out that people tend to take advantage of grant programs as well. So they're essentially a group of forensic-type investigators with a technical background, mostly in engineering. And then I also have the special investigations unit. They are primarily regional board backup work and provide technical assistance to regional boards and then do initiatives for me. And you heard probably the kernel of one of the initiatives we're working on now, which is a SEP compliance initiative. And where we'd like that to end up is with information and metrics that could potentially provide resources to the regional boards or the state board to do follow-up on SEPs and make sure there is compliance. And that would require an audit. We've begun that sort of, that process, and you heard about a couple examples that we're looking into. So we have other clients besides the regional boards. Most of our focus and our core client group is the regional boards. We provide technical and legal support for enforcement staff in the regions, but we also do for the Division of Water Rights, and that's one thing that Yvonne has a strong background in and which is a really important thing to be able to understand when working in the North Coast region in particular, because as Mr. Corbett alluded to early in the proceedings, you can't separate flows from water quality necessarily. I mean, there's parts of it you can separate, but they really are integrated. So integrating and de-siloing, if you will, the division of water rights from the regional board's enforcement actions is a really important thing that we're trying to accomplish. We represent the division in enforcement proceedings on straight water right matters as well. We represent the Division of Drinking Water now also. A lot of our work there is with operator certification issues and where there are problems with systems. Division of Financial Assistance, that's primarily our fraud unit, and then also the cleanup fund. So that's kind of what we are. Here are the amendments to the water quality enforcement policy, and I think they fall mainly, oh wait a sec, I forgot. On the bottom left there, the COHO, that's probably our most important client. And the amendments to the water quality enforcement policy fall mainly into three main categories. First of all, we have a statutory mandate now to account for the human right to water and environmental justice in our enforcement policy. So we've made several amendments to the policy to make sure that those considerations are part of how we use and deploy the enforcement policy. And we'll talk a little bit of detail about how we've done that. And then we changed the prioritization process, and I'll go into a little detail on the prioritization process, because previously it was a violation-driven process, whereas it was expected that certain types of violations would require discretionary enforcement. That's just not a workable model. So what we changed from is the violation-driven prioritization process to a case model, where we look at suites of violations and a lot of factors. We classify violations, but that's not what's driving our discretionary enforcement resources. And that's really a change that has happened over the years. This is sort of a recognition of existing practice and the way we were operating. And then finally there, we'll talk about fine-tuning the penalty methodology, and I prepared a lot of those slides as reference material, so I'm going to go over those fairly quickly and just kind of tick through them, making a few points, but also if you want to drill down on any of those things, I'm more than happy to do that, but it's kind of a mechanical aspect of application of the policy. So the human right to water and environmental justice, I mean, this is kind of the enforcement goal of the environmental justice components of the policy, and that is to ensure the fair treatment of people of all races, cultures, and income levels, including minority and disadvantaged populations in the state. And so we want to make sure as we're deploying our discretionary enforcement resources that we're thinking about that as an aspect of how we deploy those resources to make sure that we're being fair in the application of our enforcement resources. And we've done a lot of work in environmental justice communities, ways to implement this principle in practice really are to provide a greater focus on compliance assistance and progressive enforcement. Now that's something we want to do all the time, but I think we need to be more mindful of it in communities that need a leg up, maybe don't have the resources to plan in advance or have consultants to think through problem solving in advance of coming to a problem. And so I think it's a very important consideration, and I think it's a really important consideration in Region 1. in particular in the North Coast region. And I'm sorry for using the number in the North Coast region, I think it's because there are so many isolated communities that don't have the great resources that that large communities that have come together do. And so it's something that we're really mindful of, and that the policy is directing, you know, expressly directing us to consider. So these are two of the components of the policy that are in play. So in furtherance of the human right to water, the Water Board shall prioritize the enforcement of violations that involve a discharge or threatened discharge that results in or threatens to result in the contamination of a drinking water resource. So this is it's a factor that the enforcement staff considers when they determine should this be a case. So we may have a series of violations, and we may look at, well, these violations were really serious in terms of their impact beneficial uses, and that's an important factor, but do they threaten to result in the contamination of a drinking water resource? We're going to be looking at that when we prioritize whether to further an enforcement case now. It's one of the factors that we'll be considering. We're also then going to have a category, and we've met with the ORPP about the CWIX database, so that we can track violations of the human right to water and make and sort for those and make that information publicly available. So human right to water is a very important thing now, especially with the incorporation of the Division of Drinking Water into our shop, and this is a way that we're trying to further that in reality on the ground. So those were the environmental justice and human right to water considerations I wanted to cover briefly. Any questions or concerns from the board about that?
Thank you, Chris. So the words you just shared with us dealt with contamination specifically. So we're focused on drinking water, we're focused on contamination. If a neighboring property in a community that met your definition of environmental justice needs, if a neighboring property used a well and sucked dry a local drinking source, it's not a contamination, it's a water supply issue. Would that fall under this current definition?
So I should be clear too. So no, not under this definition. Now, I'm not saying we wouldn't look into that more closely and potentially engage in an enforcement action, but this is only the water quality enforcement policy. So in that situation where you're talking about a well, it may be that we would represent the Division of Drinking Water. Or the Division of Water Rights, if depending on how closely it was affiliated with stream or influence. So in a sense, that's why having all those clients work with us on enforcement means we could use the correct tool. This policy only relates to water quality enforcement. Now, we're working on developing enforcement policies that would be similar for the other divisions, but I will say that water quality is just way ahead of the game on having a firm and focused policy with respect to enforcement. So under your scenario, we'd probably look into it more closely. Probably, since you characterized it as a groundwater circumstance, we may look at that in the context of the Division of Drinking Water's authority. Any other questions on these topics? I mean, you can always bring them up later, too. I'm not going to hold you to it. Right? That's the board's prerogative.
We don't want a heavy enforcement action.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
So discretionary enforcement goals. I mean, what are we looking to do? We don't have a lot of resources to deploy in this area at the regional or state level, given all of the things that you've heard that we're engaged in. So really important to identify the greatest needs. And then the two next bullet points here, I think, are the crux of the matter. I mean, and they're like, how do we identify the greatest needs? And that is, we want to deter harmful conduct, but we also want to encourage the regulated community to anticipate, identify, and correct violations before they happen. And so this, you know, just distilled down to, you know, everything that you know that's important you learned by fifth grade, it's the carrot and the stick, right? And they go together. And these are the two things that get people to get where we need to go, because we can't go inspect every facility. We can't catch every violator, and we can't follow up on every violation. So an effective program achieves compliance through general deterrence and incentivizing compliance with regulatory standards. So I think too, underlying this concept is that enforcement is an important part, but it's just a small part of a robust regulatory program. So it is just that piece of it that means the standards in the program are meaningful and everyone's going to be held accountable. And how do we just demonstrate that? We do it with the carrot and with the stick. So talk about prioritizing enforcement and categorizing cases. So it used to be that we had three categories of violations. It was like marginal, kind of serious, and really serious. And then on the really serious violations, it was expected that the regional boards would follow up on that and take discretionary enforcement. Well, so one region's really serious violation is not another region's really serious violation. And so here in region one, a greater focus on sediment discharges is placed than in other regions. So we really, and then also we had sort of this middle ground, which was very difficult to categorize. So from a workability standpoint, what the regions did was they really looked at cases or suites of violations. And they said, well, this guy had one serious violation. He's only had one serious violation in the last 5 years. These guys have 50 intermediate violations. They're recalcitrant. They're always having violations. Why do we have to go this other way? And the answer was they didn't go the other way. So this is really a reflection of our existing process. And so the policy's been amended now. There's only two classes of violations. It's pretty serious and we're going to look more closely, or it's not that serious and we're only going to do it if it's really accumulating over time. So the first step in the process is classify the violations, because we've identified those with through site inspections or self-reporting. And then the second step in the process is, should this be a case where we deploy our discretionary resources based on the variety of factors that we're going to look at, including seriousness of the violation, does it affect the human right to water, how many violations has the person accumulated, have we prosecuted them before and they've ignored us, how much interaction has staff had with them with no result. Those are the type of factors that we'll go into. Now remember, I was a little bit glib about this is our actual practice and we weren't following the policy before, but remember in 2010, that was our first real policy with substance. The previous 2002 policy was just a narrative. And so to say, hey, look, this wasn't working and we've worked a little bit differently, this is just a transparent way to approach it. Now we also have this idea in the old policy that we would have this data algorithm that would spit out a result that would tell us where we should deploy our enforcement resources. And, you know, that's an excellent thought and idea. And it's something that we want to pursue in more detail now to figure out how we can use a tool like that. But we don't have a tool like that. We don't know how to develop a tool like that. And I understand there are some NGOs that do use a tool like that, and we'll be meeting with them soon to see how their tool works. But in a sense, it still doesn't... How does it account for the region-specific priorities? And those region-specific priorities may change from year to year as well. A regional board may be very focused on marine sediment 1 year and then change to irrigated ag the next year, depending on what the board's focus is. So the important thing to remember with this approach, we remove this requirement that we would do this, and we're going to study it and try to come up with technology that works for us. We'll see where we get there. and I would say that's a stay tuned for further information. So this is a list of the types of factors that the enforcement staff considers when they're determining whether to prioritize a case. This is sort of step two. We got all the violations, we're looking at all the violations. Should we pursue a case? Now, a case could be further inspection and a notice of violation. It could be a cleanup and abatement order. It could be a cease and desist order, or it could be a penalty action. So, and then that's part of the process too. How do these factors dictate where we should go next, right? Hey, we've got a bunch of serious violations, but we've really never engaged with this person. Let's send them a notice of violation, work with them to come into compliance, and see where we get. 3 months, 4 months, 6 months go by, nothing's getting better. Okay, let's send a cleanup and abatement order or a cease and desist order or maybe even do an administrative civil liability because they haven't corrected these things and we've engaged with them. I will say for your staff, we're generally engaging at least 2 times to try to get violations corrected before we're escalating to formal enforcement. And I think that's appropriate. People need to see, they need to understand, especially with complex regulatory schemes. So these are the type of factors we look like at when we determine, is this going to be a case? Any questions on prioritization process or how we go through that, what our thought process is there? And so this would be really something that would be very interesting, and I've talked to Matt with about, and it would be very interesting to hear the board's thoughts on where we should focus, what programs should receive the focus of enforcement. Because when we look at prioritization, I know in this region we are very focused on preservation of salmonid habitat, discharge of sediment, and protection of the natural environment. And in other regions, they may be more focused on MPDS permitting and those facilities that protect clean beaches. So perhaps it would be good to have a dialogue to say, hey, you guys should be looking at wineries, should be looking at dairy, should be looking at cannabis cultivators, should be looking at USTs, and try to get some feedback from the board so that the staff knows, hey, this is a case that the board is going to feel strongly about.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I think the dialogue would be good. There's been some questions from me, and I think from some fellow board members on cases that have been brought to us before on, why are we seeing this? We're putting a whole lot of resources and time into something that, at a high altitude, it seems like there's bigger fish to fry. Obviously, you have a reason for bringing it to us, but that communication piece isn't there, and so that could be really helpful to understand.
And I think it'd be good for the staff and for us to hear what is the board looking for on the one hand, and then also I will say that it's important for us to do a good job of saying to the board when we present a case why are we here. Mr. Corbett.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak sort of for prioritization, what I call the small fry. But that is when there's a new program where there can be resistance can be strongly anticipated. The failure to file with recorded waste discharge or under a waiver may need a temporary priority because it's not the individual cases, it's more the bigger ones. At the same time, you don't want to come in with 25 cannons on some horse hollow in file. So getting that, and I call it adaptive legal management, of which I think you folks have done a fantastic example, how you set out to get consistency in the state, you set out to get adequate resources, fraud, and toxics, and then you've looked at what's working and what isn't and have modified it. So I think your office has done a great job. But that's one of the biggest things I see is on these startup programs that are quite controversial in some of the rural areas. We need oomph to get started and to get people to want to comply. Then after that, it becomes maybe go way down your enforcement category.
So we've in the last 5 years, we've done a lot of work in emerging programs, and we've developed a strategy that I think is very effective. So in these enrollment areas where it's a new program, or maybe it's a dramatically modified program like the new industrial general stormwater permit, maybe I shouldn't say dramatically, but a modified program that requires re-enrollment, we're sending out letters saying you need to enroll. After the deadline's passed to enroll, we'll send out a letter saying you need to everyone who's not enrolled, you need to enroll, you passed the deadline, you're subject to fines and penalties, but we'll give you amnesty if you sign up within 30, 60, 90 days, whatever's a feasible time depending on the program. And then after that, we're going to pursue further enforcement. Well, that picks off the low-hanging fruit, and a lot of programs we get 70, 80% compliance with that letter because there's a threat of a fine. Then we set out a low-level fine and say, here's your fine. You want to contest it? Maybe it's between $1,000 and $5,000 depending on the program, right? In irrigated ag, it was $1,000. And so then we get a whole bunch of other people saying, oh boy, you know, do I really want to go before the board and argue over $1,000? You know, no. And so then we get a whole bunch more people sign up. And when we did this in the IGSP program, Industrial General Stormwater Permit Program, we had almost 300 non-enrollees, and then we had 35 that didn't take advantage of the amnesty, and then I think we had 6 or 7 left after the first set of fines, and then we were like, hey, you know, these people are avoiding us, so that's where we're going to put our focus. So going through that kind of, that progressive approach has been very effective.
And I, that's what I call deputy legal management. I compliment you in that direction.
So I come from Trinity County, definitely under the definition of disadvantaged communities. And so my question is about the marijuana cultivation. And I can see, and you've done great work with enforcement from one of our wastewater projects we had, the Lewiston, giving warning,
yes,
helping them move forward. The cannabis or marijuana industry is like a pop-up business. Here, gone. And I think what we're running into is the, let's send out letters, let's wait for a response. They just wait you out, and then they're gone. So I don't think that that process and strategy is going to work for all businesses.
John.
Well, I wanted to say, I didn't get into it, but as you progress up, then you need to get on liens on property, and I realize that's a cumbersome process. When you're doing a whole lot of them, you're going to have to geographically, locate them and schedule them in the courts. But without a lien on the property, I agree with Board Member Kelly, but I do believe liens have worked in other marijuana programs like the Humboldt County Assessor's Office. They have a much more favorable lien situation. I know it's cumbersome for you, but I do think at that point the property owner is responsible, and that's a key element to making it work.
Let me finish.
Yes, go ahead.
So aside from the lien thing, which I don't think works, I just think that it's a great program. I think maybe we look at each category of business, and there's a different way you go approach those, because a farmer or a winery who is, they have an entrenched permanent business, yes, we can handle them a lot different than people who disappear and are on property they don't own. Most of the property that we're running into is owned by people on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So,
Alabama.
So anyway, I'm just wondering if you had thought about these businesses that are very quick turnover.
Indeed.
And how to get
their We've been thinking about that and working on that problem in my office for almost 5 years now. And so when I've done a lot of work personally in Trinity County, and my staff and the Region 1 staff has been into Trinity County. And so the model works with persons who want to comply and are legitimate business people. It does not work with others. And so the cannabis program is very challenging because, as you've indicated, you don't have a lot of dairies that are not open for business in the daylight. And so it's a very challenging program, and it needs a mixed approach. But this is an approach we work with. We're going to be taking with enrollment, give people a chance to daylight their operation and enroll and comply with the permit. And those who are not going to cooperate or be willing to do that, that they have to be in a different, they should be in a different, on a different path.
Yeah, the name of that industry, we shorten the cycles. And, you know, you don't give them 30 days to reply to a letter, you give them a week and a half. I mean, because they get the crops done and they're out and they could care less and they pull everything out.
I understand.
Citations sometimes work, yeah. That's true.
Okay, so, so what another thing I would love to do, so I'm always looking for an excuse to come to Santa Rosa, so, and also to address this board. You know, we could definitely talk about the cannabis program and do have a detailed dialogue about the cannabis program. You might come back and talk about SEPs, cannabis, and priorities, and I would love to do that. John.
I just want to say no aspect of the marijuana program is going to do it alone. One advantage of liens is sense to the property owner. And I can tell you that will undo years of court proceedings, whether the owner knew someone was growing or not. You get a lien, and even if you successfully challenge it, you're then charged with knowledge that's going on, and that allows you to focus in again a little bit on it. And it's a complex system. Nothing is a panacea, but I did want to say notice to the landowners, because there are a lot of people who don't know it. I know of one road where a guy came on and offered to patrol it off or to keep the marijuana off, and then he grew marijuana off.
I think I know that same road.
You know, so
I know several
that
roads like
lack
that.
Of knowledge, but we have to find a way to break it, and the notice to the property owner is a great way to do it, and it perks people right up. I know as a property owner.
We've identified that a key focus has to be the property owner, because that's a person that has a stake in the outcome of a proceeding. And property owners are liable for actions that happen on their land. And when we do a cleanup and abatement order, we do name the landowner. So part of that is getting the word out. You got to be a steward of your property. And this is not a criminal proceeding where you can say, oh, I didn't know about it. If it happened on your land under the water code, you're strictly liable for the consequences of it. And that's the position we take, and that's been upheld by the court. So, oh, I didn't know about it, it's not going to be a defense. So there are lots of tools and lots of ways to talk about this, and we stretch our tools to the limit in every box on this program.
One comment that's a little bit broader in response to Board Member Hale's comment about cases that make their way all the way to this board. And just a couple of broad things that I think about are, I think this has already been mentioned, but the, you know, very clear documentation that the discharger has had the opportunity to understand their violation and the opportunity to remedy that. And then the other thing I think is when there are multiple agencies involved in an investigation, clear explanation as to why this is the appropriate agency to be taking enforcement action. You know, maybe multiple agencies are taking enforcement action, but I think that kind of information is really helpful for us to understand our place in the landscape of multiple agencies with interest in those issues.
So we're touching the tip of the iceberg on the kind of feedback that we would hope to, you know, be able to get. And again, Matt and I have had a dialogue about this, but I don't know how far it's gotten.
Well, this is exactly why we wanted to have this item, which is kind of tease up the interest around the enforcement policy and the changes to it, and then lead to a subsequent item that we'll bring to the board will be a discussion about prioritization and how the thought process that we as staff go through to decide on which cases we're going to pursue, and then getting your guidance on how we do that prioritization. So you can look forward to that sometime late this calendar year or early next calendar year.
We will look forward to it.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for the really good feedback.
Oh, yeah, everyone. You're not done yet, right?
No.
Oh, okay. Wait.
No. I'm far from done. See, that's what I like about my dialogue. So they go, oh, you've got so much time to give your presentation. And I'm like, well, I like to do dialogue. And then that ends up being better, right? Because you end up having that anyway. And then we do it as we go. So
I do actually, I want to just interrupt to say, at this point, with where we are on the clock, just to let everyone in the room know that after this item, we'll take a lunch break and come back. So if people are planning their schedules around which item they want to be here for, we'll be taking lunch after this one.
So there's lots of detail in the next section, and I did prepare this as sort of a reference tool. Feel free to drill down. I'm going to cover some things quickly. The way the enforcement policy penalty calculation method is worked is based on the statutory factors. So if you look up here, all of these are things in the statute that the board is required to consider when they impose a statutory penalty. And when the staff does a settlement, it's the same thing. These are the things that they're supposed to consider. And so the policy basically provides guidance on how they're considered and how they're considered in relation to each other. And so essentially, that's all it does is each of the factors to be considered are these, and then how they relate to each other and whether each is severe or moderate or mild, basically says gives guidance on how the board should look at it. So I want to make sure that it's really clear here that the way the policy works, these are supposed to be dials on the two sides. One goes up to 11 on the right-hand side. So basically, the board is required to make evidence-supported findings to support the liability that it reaches. But the way the policy comes out, the ultimate number, what the penalty is really subject to the board's consideration and adjustment of those dials, right? So the various factors can be assessed in a variety of ways by the regional boards in the way they apply the statute. So the idea is that there's considerable flexibility in the application of the statute based on the things to consider, but if it's a really harmful sediment discharge discharge that results in a fish kill, that's something where you're probably going to come out with the same assessment of that factor. Does that mean you have to come out with the same penalty? Not at all. You have many other considerations, including economic benefit, ability to pay, culpability, all of those other things that weigh into the determination. So an important consideration here in the policy is fairness. And fairness in the context of the policy does not mean leniency. And actually, leniency is not under the definition of fairness in any dictionary that I looked in prior to this presentation. Actually, what it means is that we want to reward those who voluntarily incur the cost of compliance by leveling the playing field and not giving an economic benefit to cheaters. And that's basically the concept of fairness. Fairness means leveling the playing field for the regulated public. So that's the way the enforcement policy definition of fairness works. Consistency, also an important objective of the policy. But consistency doesn't mean you have to come to the same result because it's the same kind of violation. What it means is you're going to apply the same formula and you're going to look at the statutory factors in the same way. And this is a concept that's been upheld in the federal sentencing guidelines and in other contexts. It doesn't have to be an exactly equivalent result. It just has to be an application of a consistent thought process. And so here we're looking for evidence-supported findings in support of each of the factors, and then the result is reached by going through that process, consistently applying the same process. So here are the changes to the methodology. I told you I was going to go quickly over that. The thing I think it's important to realize about some of these factors is that some are mitigating, where you can reduce the baseline penalty. Some are enhancement, where you can increase. In those cases, you're not required. You can maintain them neutral. And some could go either way, where you could mitigate or reduce. So the factors have been adjusted in the policy, but it's important to realize in applying the factors, you can mitigate, enhance, or one or the other or both is going to apply to a variety of the factors. So for example, if you looked at susceptibility to cleanup, one thing we did there in the statute, it says the board should consider whether it's susceptible to cleanup. And so we thought, well, what they meant was it really cleaned up? And so we had cases where people would argue, well, it was susceptible to clean up, so we should get a credit for that, even though we didn't actually clean it up. And we said, no, we're going to clarify that. Not only is it susceptible to clean up, but you actually got to do it within a reasonable time. So, you know, it's an inartful piece of the statute that we clarified in the policy, because after lawyers get a hold of it, you get these crazy ambiguous arguments. Right? We all know that. So some other changes we made, fine-tuning the methodology. One thing that's important, I think, we have a lot of reporting violation issues, and those can tend to really pile up in the number of days of violation. So we allow for what we call collapsing the days of violation for reporting violations. So whereas if you had a year, say you have a cleanup and abatement order and you blow the deadline for a year, you know, that a cleanup and abatement order deadline is an important milestone. It's important to be working with staff to meet those deadlines. Okay, so a year later, the staff's been working with you, you haven't been able to achieve compliance, that's 365 days of violation. Well, where there's a direct impact on water quality, which is in the cleanup and abatement order context, we don't allow this collapsing of days. You've been in violation for 365 days. Where you fail to submit a monitoring report that doesn't have a direct impact on water quality, a 365-day violation would actually be 41 days of violation. One day for each of the first 30 days, and then one day for each month after that. So that's 30 plus 11, 41 days. So for reporting violations, we're going to acknowledge that after a while, the report doesn't matter, it's stale. It, you know, we're going to reduce that. You still should be submitting it, but we're going to allow collapsing. People have called these paper violations. The important thing is to distinguish between what really is a paper violation and what's a violation that may affect water quality. So deadline in a CAO, deadline in an investigation order where we're looking at a spill, those kind of things are not paper violations. So that's one thing we clarified. We gave some guidance on the high volume discount and extended it to other things besides sewage. Basically, applies now to any kind of waste. Further changes to the methodology. For example, here, cleanup and cooperation is one that can mitigate or enhance. So if you take the baseline penalty and you're at $10, let's say, and you feel like this party did a lot to try to clean up after the spill or cooperate with analyzing the impacts, you could mitigate that down and multiply it by 0.75 and be at $7.50. If you felt like the person just blew you off, didn't investigate, had a chance to clean up but didn't, you could enhance the penalty up to $15. So it's an example of one of those factors that can go below or above, as culpability is similarly couched in that way. So if it's something where you've done a lot to avoid the problem, and yet you still had it, but it's a serious violation, you might go from $10 to $7.50. If it's something where you were negligent, didn't engage in proper capital improvements or employee training, it could go up to $15.
So,
Greg,
let me stop you there, because it gets back to what Mr. Hale and Ms. Minton talked about, you know, what comes before us. The three cases that have come to this board while I've been on it, you know, much to the chagrin and I'm sure the annoyance of the prosecutors, we've had some disagreements when it comes to assessing the ability to pay and the degree of culpability. I think that, you know, in our closed session, that's essentially what we focused on. And I think that's the, even though I totally accept and agree with the need to a standardized formula and prescription of how, where you plug the numbers in, assessing those values, that's when we get into the subjectivity, and that's where we've had the rub between the prosecutors and this board. I'm not sure how you get through that, but I say two of the three cases that have come before me, it's been consistent that those are the two parameters that have have been the biggest challenge for the membership of this board. You know, how do, just because somebody has all their assets, maybe that's not the measure of what they're able to pay. And then what's a mistake versus a violation in terms of culpability? You know, I mean, things happen. And those, again, at least for speaking for myself and my interpretation of my colleagues on the board, that's where we had the biggest disagreement with what was brought to us. In addition, the other thing that I think sets the tone of the discussions of this board is the length of time and the amount of resources that go into a particular case that can't be resolved before it gets to the board, and then the scope and scale of that case. I think, as Mr. Hale pointed out, that I think he was talking about the last case we dealt with. At least for me, speaking for myself, it seemed that it should have been resolved long before it got to us, and in a matter of weeks, not 2.5 years. So those are all the things sitting in our end that, you know, we're processing through our filters, knowing what we know, living and working out in the region, and how we hold things in context. Again, there is some, even though the formula may be standardized, there's a tremendous amount of subjectivity on that scale that you just shared with us. And from my own personal experience, that's where the rub has been. And, you know, how those, what numbers are assigned in that prescription based on that sliding scale.
I think that's really great feedback, and I feel like these are things that we're trying to work through and overcome, and I look forward to working with more frequency in front of the board as do my prosecutors. Just two quick things. One is, during the time that you've seen three cases, we've probably settled 60.
Oh, sure.
Right, and so, you know, you see the outliers, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then the second thing is, we've really, based on feedback from this board, we've really amended the ability to pay component of the policy. John?
Oh, I just want to say, one of the things I struggle with as a board member, and I think you see this in ag or any really the non-point source, a particular violation may not amount to a hill of beans on demonstrated damage to water quality. What we're trying to do in the regulation is accumulative impacts, which can be enormous off of a very tiny set of impacts. And that's just, if you got any suggestions how to weigh that out, you have to take it seriously, because if you get 100 of them, you got a problem. If you have one, it's you're not going to see, sometimes you can, but ordinarily you're not going to see damage to the water quality.
And so that's why the enhancement factors are important, and also when we talked earlier, it's striking the right balance so that it's changing conduct. Because if you have 100 violations because it's perceived that you can get away with that, then you're going to have those 100 violations, especially in certain contexts, especially in the emerging programs. And so, you know, that's the important thing is, got to exceed the economic benefit so that a rational economic actor is not going to engage in harmful misconduct.
Just to follow up, I appreciate how hard your shop works and how much work you get done and how you complete so many of these. And maybe we do see the outliers, but that's what's presented to us. Those are the ones we're asked to pass judgment on.
I get it.
And so even though they may be the exception and not the rule, you know, sitting in this seat, that's what we're dealing with.
I would
suggest that some self-reflection, you know, if you're going to bring something to the board, it should be a big deal in our mind. And maybe it's a big deal in your mind,
or explain to us why it's a big deal.
Explain to us more why it's a big deal.
That's it. But I think this is a good time for me to clarify. So we provide legal support for these cases. These cases are brought, developed, and determined to be important by your staff. It's not my staff that does that. So it's the assistant executive officer and the branch chiefs and the enforcement staff that emphasize and prioritize the importance of these cases. And so as an attorney, they come to us and say, this is a case we want to bring. Now, we may say to them, you sure about that? Or we may say, yeah, this is a good one. We're 100% behind you. We have that dialogue, but ultimately, we do not make that call.
I understand that. My comments weren't just directed to the two of you. They're directed to your entire world. I'm hoping everybody in this room is listening to the comments of this board.
Yeah.
We're just not picking on you.
No, I understand that
too. But I just wanted to make that clear because I actually have two board members I don't think I've addressed before here today. So on the ability to pay side, you know, we have this issue. It's cat and mouse. Do we know how much money a person has, especially in the cannabis cultivation context where we don't? How can we tell? You know, I mean, it's like, okay, well, it's like you have a big bulge in your pocket there. So it's really challenging to figure that out. So what we've kind of said is we will issue subpoenas for financial information, and we would look at your financial information. If you refuse to comply with the subpoena, then we're going to tell the board that, and you should not be allowed to argue that you have an inability to pay if you're not going to provide financial information. And chances are, and so most people that can't pay, they can show you why they can't pay. So this is going to be our regular process. We're going to go through this process so that we have meaningful information to present on why are we mitigating this penalty so much, or why are we not recommending a mitigation on ability to pay. So, and those were uncontroversial in the adoption of the policy. I kind of expected to hear that I shouldn't be issuing those subpoenas, but that came out fine.
Must be lunchtime.
Yeah, that must have been it. Yeah. So here, talk about settlement. I mean, that's the methodology. That was great. Any further inquiries on the methodology? Anything you noticed that piqued your interest? We talk about settlement considerations. We've touched on this some already. The staff uses the same approach as the regional board would. They go through and assess the statutory penalty factors. And then we've changed our practices over the years. Instead of just throwing out a complaint, then we engage with the discharger and we talk with that person and we say, hey, have we got this right? What's your side of the story? Do you have additional facts or information that we should consider? Almost universally, it results in a reevaluation of our assessment of the case. At least on some factors, you know, given the 10 factors, we don't know everything that happened necessarily as much as they do. And then we determine a range of possibilities, like how far can we turn the dials and settle a case? And that's why the vast majority of cases do settle. And then if it's outside of the range of possibilities, then that's when we come to the board, right? Where the staff is uncomfortable going outside that range, then we think it is the board's job to take that. Now, we need to do a better job, obviously, working on what, you know, where's the board's comfort level so that staff feels how far they can turn the dials to. And that's why I think this part of the dialogue is really important, as would be future. So when we reach a settlement agreement, we memorialize it in the form of a stipulated order. So everyone's saying, okay, I agree with this order. It's negotiated by the enforcement staff under the methodology. It's an agreement by the discharger that it will pay the liability or do the compliance project or SEP, Supplemental Environmental Project, or take further injunctive actions to restore property or other properties that were damaged. And then it goes up for public comment as the stipulated order and settlement agreement, and it goes through a 30-day public comment period where the board can receive comments on the merits of the settlement agreement, or the board itself could ask that the matter be scheduled for a board hearing. So during that 30-day public comment, so Matt, the executive officer, has a delegation to agree to most settlement agreements. I mean, there's a limit, but for the all intents and purposes, we don't really exceed the limit here, maybe once every 5 years. So Matt has the authority to sign the settlement agreement. If we don't get public comment and the board doesn't ask for a public hearing, he signs it, right, usually. I mean, he might also make the call that, hey, I'm not going to cite this hot potato. I'm going to send it back to the board. And I've had that happen in other regions, but Matt hasn't had to do that yet. So there are a lot of opportunities. There's a 30-day window for a lot of things to happen where the matter doesn't end up settling as agreed to by the parties, but then comes to be heard by the board. We haven't had that happen in this region, but it's a strong possibility. I want the board members to know that it's their prerogative when a settlement agreement's up there, if they want to ask questions even about what why this SEP, why not, you know, those kinds of things, that is their prerogative. So now we're going to move from settlement to alternatives in, and I know just briefly, many of you are familiar with this, there are three types of alternatives to collecting money in from penalty action. One is the supplemental environmental project. Essentially, that's an environmentally beneficial project that the person is not otherwise obligated to perform or would not be undertaken in the absence of the enforcement action. So can't be a benefit to them or their regulatory obligations. A compliance project applies to resolve all or a portion of a mandatory minimum penalty against a POTW, publicly owned treatment works, that serves a small community with a financial hardship. And there are many of those on the North Coast, and we do a lot of compliance projects in the North Coast so that all of a penalty action can go to a disadvantaged POTW to improve and enhance those their systems and the components of those systems that resulted in the violation. And that's a statutory vehicle that we are allowed to use. And then we have enhanced compliance action, and that basically allows the discharger to make a capital or operational improvement beyond what's required by law and is separate from projects designed to bring the discharger into compliance. So this is like when the staff person saying, wouldn't it be cool if you just changed your facility to work in a different way? And that would be much more efficient if you did that. And the discharger is saying, well, I don't have to do that because I can comply based on my existing operational procedures. But isn't this a really cool idea? And so that's what you can do with enhanced compliance actions. And so to animate that a little bit, I had a sewer agency in Region 8, and they have a force main that is situated in a creek bed for about a half a mile, and it's been there since the 1930s or 40s. And they had a big rupture, and they had an 8-day beach closure from a multi-million gallon sewer spill. And so we're looking at it, and they're saying, well, we're gonna fix it, the pipe, you know, and we're saying, can't you just get that pipe out of the creek bed? I mean, this is a bad design. We want to have a better design. And they're like, well, it's on our long-term capital improvement list. It's like an $8 million project. We kind of don't know if we're really ever going to get around to doing it. We agree it's a good idea. I don't know if our ratepayers are going to go for it. And I said, well, what if we took half the money and gave it as seed money, and you put this on your 1 year, on your immediate capital improvement plan? And then they were like, okay, we'll do it. So that's the kind of thing where it's an enhanced compliance action. Does it benefit the system? Yeah. Is it something they have to do to come into compliance? No. And so we can incentivize those. A big reason we did that, too, was we were able to leverage their existing capital pool with the fine money. Supplemental environmental projects. This is what I want to talk about a bit. So I want to emphasize it's voluntary. So we cannot compel dischargers to do SEPs or to fund SEPs. They have to agree to them. The reason is there's no command and control authority to impose SEPs in the water code. We have put together different pieces of the Administrative Procedures Act and the water code and the government code into an analysis that says, we can agree with parties to do SEPs as part of a settlement. So it has to be part of a settlement. The discharger has to agree to it. It cannot have a benefit to the discharger. And we just covered that kind of a bit about what that means. It can't be designed to bring them into compliance. Now, if it's a city and they're doing a wetlands restoration project across town, I mean, there is a benefit there, but that's not the kind of benefit we're talking about. No benefit to the water boards, and it cannot fund water board programs. It is supplemental to our needs and our programs. There must be a nexus to the violation, so it has to be in the same community, or it has to be the same kind of program. So wetlands fill could be a restoration project. So subject matter or geographic nexus. And there's no parking of funds, which means you can't just accumulate penalty money in an account until a SEP comes along that you want to purchase. And so that's kind of the dialogue I wanted to lead into, in some extent we touched on earlier. If there's a pre-approved list of board SEPs at a variety of dollar amounts, because you see valuable projects that are $2,000 to $5,000, trash cleanups and other things that are really valuable, then the staff has this suite of things that it can just go to and say, the board's already vetted this list. Now, in the context of environmental justice, we are now statutorily obligated to have a SEP list that benefits environmental justice communities. Now, when I say we, that means the water boards. And so this year, we complied by the statute with the statute by and it was a quick deadline, reaching out to all the regional boards and saying, give us your list, and posting one list on the state board's webpage. And that complies with the statute, but our sense is better practice, because regional boards are independent state agencies, would be to have an approved environmental justice list of SEPs at each region. Now, that's not necessarily required. You don't necessarily have to do that. You can still take the state board approach. But that means there are any SEPs for your staff to pick in your region that would benefit the EJ folks in this region when they're bringing enforcement actions and settling cases. So I think it's important. It's an important springboard not only to have these EJ SEPs, a suite of those that can be selected, but also other SEPs that are important that are being offered by non-governmental organizations or other JPAs are a really good source of projects to fund with SEP money. And that's what Dr. Horn was talking about. They have programmatic SEPs through the IRWIMP implementation groups in their region. And so they have responsible parties implementing meaningful projects in their regions, and then a direct nexus to kind of those geographic areas. So best practices, we think, is to have a board-approved list. Part of it, it's fun to do those outreach meetings where you have persons come in from the communities and talk about projects and vet them, and you say, well, what's your budget? What are your milestones? What's your project description? And, you know, kind of get them on and enthused about, you know, developing something that's creative and meaningful. So, and that's something we could talk more about, what some of the other regions have done, and I can give you some examples of, for example, there's an environmental justice SEP that's organized in Region 5 in the Central Valley region now. There's the programmatic SEP, which doesn't have an environmental justice component, that's used in the Lahontan region that you heard Dr. Horn speak to today, just reference really. And then there's also a programmatic SEP that's underway in Region 3 in the Central Coast. So there are some limitations on how you can structure these, and I'd be more than happy to present on how that goes. But I think it's get a list together that where the board's vetted it, so that these are projects that the board supports and feels like the penalty money should go to. It's 50% limit on the civil liability. It has to be voluntary, and you have to do enforcement to generate the money. So those are kind of the main gateways into the SEP process. There we go. There's my main client. So any questions on SEPs or really anything for Yvonne or I?
Processing from the board, and looking forward to a future item. Do we have any public comment cards on this item?
No, we do not.
We do not. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your presentation. Look, oh,
If I could speak.
Good afternoon, today's chairman and members of the board. I'm Don Mockinghill with Russian Riverkeeper. I've spent a lot of time talking to staff and Mad St. John about the topic of enforcement, and it's pretty clear from listening to Chris, we're seeing kind of the tip of the iceberg as far as enforcement activity, and so we would absolutely love to see more transparency as far as public knowledge of the enforcement actions. So with that, you know, I'm here to talk about the importance of enforcement, and really I look at it as pretty simple. I'm like many other people. I exceed the speed limit sometimes when I'm late. It's pretty clear when I do that, I have a very a lot of anxiousness and nervousness about being caught, because I've probably paid over $5,000 in speeding tickets since I was 16. I'm late a lot. Actually, I used to drive 40,000 miles a year, and that was hard. More than 75% of the time, I comply with the speed limit out of fear of getting caught. Obviously, that's the deterrent effect we all want to see with our state laws. It reduces the cost of enforcement with staff. You know, of course, sometimes the CHP doesn't give me a ticket. They give me a warning. And when I get those warnings, I drive like a saint for the next 2 days. That is a very balanced approach to enforcement. There's some education and some enforcement. But when I get a ticket, I pay that ticket. There's no wiggling out of it. I certainly, and I've been vocal with Matt and other members of the staff, that I feel like from what we can see in the public, we don't see a lot of enforcement activity, and we see a lot of violations. So obviously, you know, that is the state government's job, to implement and enforce regulations to protect our right to clean water and full attainment of beneficial uses, which we don't enjoy right now. We have so many pollution impairments, and I don't see the trend going up. I see it flat to downward. So, you know, we all need to remind ourselves at this board and in the community that it is your duty to protect water quality. You are the water cops. And from what we can see in the public, we're not using that tool. And we don't see high rates of compliance. That's your mission and your obligation, and I hope you always remember that. You know, I've heard people comment who work for this board that we don't want to be the big bad regulator. You're the water cops. That's what you do. That's your job. That's what you get paid for. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Don, for your comments.
Can I just make one reply? Then I want to remind the board and others that when we completed our strategic visioning and planning process a couple of years ago, we developed 5 strategic initiatives, and having an effective and efficient enforcement program is one of those 5 strategic initiatives. So from us on a staff level, we and those initiatives were endorsed by our board. So we are definitely committed to it. It is an evolving process. And I recognize that as a region, we could do more, and that's something that we're working on.
Comment here, Madam Chairman. Just as an aside, yesterday during my briefing with Matt, I did make the comment at the back of our package where there was the list of enforcement actions going on. I commented at how many there were. There's 3 pages worth, and I hadn't seen that many in my time on the board. And so I think what you just heard from Matt is sincere and honest. I think they are taking enforcement seriously, as I think you always have. The take-home message, though, I think we heard from several people today, is that link to the outside world, the transparency of letting people know what actions are being done and what follow-up is, you know, whether it's improving the webpage or whether it's your
your reports, or however we can share that information. You know, we've heard that from more than one person today, and that's what's resonated with me. In addition to what I mentioned yesterday in my briefing was, three full pages of actions, where normally it's, a page and a half. So something's changed in the recent months, and it was obvious in my report anyway.
Well, if there are no other comments from board or public, we will recess to lunch for 1 hour, coming back at 1:30 p.m.